You're listening to Circle of Hope's Sunday Meeting Podcast. This talk was given at 2309 North Broad Street. For more information, check out circleofhope.net or join us in person on Sunday evenings at 5 and 7 p.m.
We're talking about the power of withstanding trouble and holding on to our faith in spite of it. We're considering how we can withstand huge forces of evil around us, inside of us and outside of us. Things that we cannot conceive of defeating. And therein lies the mystery that we don't need to conquer. We don't need to defeat. We don't need to win. That's not, I think, how fullness is expressed in the gospel. Through Jesus, we need to learn to wait, to endure. In the first week of Advent, we're looking to the prophets who endured disaster, especially the Old Testament prophets. They withstood it. These people who, in many cases, with only a relationship with God to sustain them, ignored, isolated, marginalized, oppressed, sometimes even called crazy. They withstood the disaster, they suffered with it. And when we think of prophets, that's where my mind goes, people that aren't crazy, but are deeply empathetic to God's concerns. A prophet is one who empathizes with the pathos of God. The prophet cares about what God cares about. And they specialize in enduring pain and suffering. And they give us a way to imagine a new world and new possibilities. But it starts with their passion. It starts with their ability to empathize. Maybe when you imagine a prophet, you think of a very smart person or somebody who incisively calls out truth. Or maybe even someone who sees the future. I'm really talking about a prophet as someone who deeply feels. And I don't know how popular that is. They're close to God, they collect their power from that empathy. And when we think about people like that, that are very emotional, that's almost a pejorative if someone's emotional. It's a way to dismiss somebody. Have you ever experienced this? If you're acting hysterical, someone will say, "You're being too emotional. You just got to rationally think about this." You know, their reason will save them. You know, people like the prophets we think of as pathetic. They're Snape for some reason. What's so bad about being pathetic? What do you think about pathetic people, people you would describe this way? These characters, these people that arouse pity, sorrow, remorse, you feel bad for them. We assign them a sort of weakness, don't we? It's not surprising that that term pathos in pathetic has a negative connotation. Why do we think of that as bad? Right? Being pathetic, it's an emotional reaction to something that happens to an individual. Pathos is a, some would say, a form of argumentation coupled with ethos. Pathos is about appealing to emotion. I like those kinds of arguments. Appeal to my heart, I'll follow you. You can see it develop, especially in the Greek poetry. The words about, in English, about evoking a sad or negative feeling. But eventually it earned a negative connotation. That's what we think of when we think of pathetic, right? Nietzsche said that it wasn't until Beethoven that music found the language of pathos, of passionate will, of dramatic occurrence in the souls of people. Beethoven was a prophet in his own right. Of course, Nietzsche thought that passionate displays were just pathetic displays of weakness. He famously said, "Wit is the epitaph of emotion." Let's just think about what that means for a second. The epitaph is the final word on someone's life. Like some of you have constructed your epitaph. Maybe. No? Maybe I think about this too much. Wit can be defined as reason, being clever. Reason trumps emotion. Reason concludes emotion, so to speak. That's the argument. Pathos is a pity which tragedy is supposed to evoke, a painful, sorrowful expression of suffering, as compared to the stoic grandeur of the tragic hero. You know this character? This is why we love the strong character, right? The one who can endure suffering and not be moved. But if you suffer tragedy and you feel sad or weak or you're suffering, not so good. The stoic hero can endure a tragedy, but the fundamentally weak character, who is so obvious, usually in her suffering, cast down. Like these two. You guys ever seen Les Mis, right? The Miserables, as I like to call it. We like Jean Valjean, the wretched. What's her name? Fantine. It's like a cheese, sorry. You know, Fantina? Never mind. Fantine. We pity her and we want to be more like him. At least that seems to be the arc of the story. That's why we love stories about hard-working men who suffer tragedy, but rarely empathize with the poor widows, besides to offer them a sort of excess of our philanthropy. We'll give them some change, but we don't want to be like them. There's something about suffering and expressively suffering that we don't respect, or we're taught not to. I don't mean to generalize about all of you. So we accommodate a pathetic person, but we obligate ourselves then to empathize with the stoic hero's suffering. So we like the people unmoved. Of course, postmodern cinema has made a mockery of this, as it has everything. So a stoic character is mocked when we show their emotional weakness. It's a good move to undo the damage that Nietzsche and his comrades have done to us and to God. But we still think, I think, of emotion as a sign of weakness. To be compelled, if you're compelled to do something by emotion, through sorrow, you seem impressionable, inconsistent, not resolute. But if you stand firm in your ground and you're unmoved by whatever circumstances are around you, sometimes we respect that. I'm laughing because it sounds crazy to not be moved by suffering around you, but to keep going. Steadfast leadership. Never change your mind. Never flip or flop. We herald these ideas. And if you ever made it, I mean, this is amazing. If you ever changed your mind, if you ever said something in the past that was foolish, someone will find the citation and tell you, "I remember when you said this." So emotion might be a sign of weakness. Plato said the soul's highest value is reason, not its appetite, not its impulse. The body is a container for the soul, he said. A finite one, the body that goes away with death. Stoics and Epicureans, the ones that Paul, by the way, in Acts 6:17, is fighting, not fighting, kind of playfully arguing with as he awaits his friends. He's running away from some town where they hate him, and he found himself in Athens, and he's holding court with the Stoics and the Epicureans. The body is fleeting, the soul lasts. To Aristotle, God has no pathos at all. God is centered on reason. And I'm telling you about Greek things because we are in the unfortunate circumstance of being too influenced by Greek theology. The early church was formed in a very Hellenistic society, and so we collected some of their cultural influence. And because they were so early, we incorporate it. I think it's okay for them to express their faith in a Greek-y way. I think it's fine. But to herald it as the best way to see and view God, well, that's a bigger discussion. To Aristotle, God is no pathos at all, centered on reason. Jewish philosophers are moved by Aristotle, even more than their Hebrew Bible. Greek theology, I want to get this slide, has attributed to God the power of thinking, but has excluded the realm of emotion. Clement, early church father, coalesced to Greeks, calling a saint someone who is removed from him, his, or her passions. And if reason is impersonal and emotion is personal, if reason is impersonal and emotion is personal, then God, who is fundamentally personal, capital P, may have a reason to disregard reason himself. Perhaps rather than assuming that pathos is an anthropomorphic way of describing God, when we see in the Bible God's displays of emotion, we could just say that's giving God human characteristics so that we understand God. I think it's the other way around. Passion is the way that God is relating to us, not the way that we relate to God. Thomas Aquinas said that God was unmoving without passion, because passion must change God. And so they really doubled down on this unmoving God. But to a biblical person, being is a surprise, not the beginning. God is the ultimate in the Bible, not being. God is even above, not changing. There is a beginning, and then there's creation. It teaches us something about this dialectical relationship between postmodernism and modernism, one where you are socially constructing your reality and one where it is cemented for you. We need a third way of thinking about God in order to endure disaster and difficulty. We need to think about God in a new way. Humans have tried to make an image of God that they understand. That might be an abomination. The prophetic passion is not an attempt to depict God, but simply to understand God. One can't really effectively describe God, one can only praise God. That's the kind of humble submission we have before our Lord. The whole narrative, this whole idea, reminds us of Jesus, the incarnate God. It gives meaning to Jesus' passion, the passion of Christ. He comes to suffer with us. He comes so that we can get close to our own suffering and not be afraid. To experience it, not to avoid it. Not to avoid all the emotions that come, but to endure it. The personal, relatable, loving characteristics of Jesus were with God the whole time. The incarnation isn't about a new version of God, it's about a complete revelation of God. When Jesus says he comes to fulfill the law, he really means it. It's not an abolition of the old, it's a completion. God reveals, and that gives us a new imagination about the whole world. I think too often, when we think of problems with the world, we think the solution to them is a conquest or a revolution. But I think we need to keep seeing how God is working in the world and make a big deal of that. I think our job is to clarify, crystallize, make clear where God is. Not to succumb to the social agents of the world who know how to manipulate it. That's what the Old Testament prophets really did. That's what Advent is all about. Lighting up the world. Telling them really what to wait for. Pointing to Jesus. All these images you see, the star guides them. The prophets, a long time ago, just turning on the lights. They are concerned with God's concerns, and they reorient us. So I want something more. I don't think I'm deluding myself in saying something more exists, and God is bringing about, birthing something new in us. We just have to keep paying attention to it. We have to develop eyes and ears for it. We have to move with God and develop a body for it, enact it, name it. God is working out a world redemption project. Starts with creation, moves to enact it with his chosen people, promises them salvation, then grafts the rest of us on through the saving power of Jesus. The resurrection life begins at the start of time, and now we're all participating in it, thanks to Jesus. That's the big idea. That's the reality of the meaning of the world. God authored meaning in all things, and we're turning on the lights. But when we can't see it, because we're too fearful, too anxious. When we think that this is all there is, we lose our imagination to see the world as it might be, or see how it's working now. When we're just afraid, we can't get near our suffering, because we're really just trying to avoid it. When Jesus saves us, we can then get close to our pain and not be afraid. We can grieve with God. You know, if all we did as Christians was turn on the light to really see what's going on, that would be great. I think we'd be better off. Maybe sharing the gospel is about clarifying people's vision, not giving them new content. Help them to see. Opening their ideas to the good that God is doing in the world, but to the suffering also that's happening despite that. I think sometimes that very suffering is undone by naming goodness. I was telling someone today, try to see the good things about yourself, the good things about your relationship. It's so easy to dwell on what isn't working. Name what is. Be encouraged. Be supported. You have good things given to you by God. We can stand by disaster because of what God has done. A prophet's lonely. His or her standards are high. Stature is great. Concern too intense for other people to share, even sometimes. God is her company. So how did the prophets brave disaster? They showed the world. I wonder if I have a slide that you can look at. They showed the world what God cares about, and they answered to God, and they worshiped. How do we sustain our vision? How do we stand by the disaster that's happening around us? We have to keep reverberating the promise of salvation. It's good to do the tradition again. The calendar, the liturgical calendar, guides us. We keep saying the same story. We need to be reminded of it all the time. For Israel, that's why they keep observing Passover. The remembrance of their Exodus. Keep sharing the story. Keep talking about it. Remember when God freed us from our Egyptian slavers. This is the story that sustained Israel, captivity to captivity, empire to empire. And today it still sustains people, and even Christians. Especially those under some oppression are sustained by the promise of God's deliverance. We still remember it. We still share the story. Stay connected. Keep remembering. Christians, we do the same thing with our own story. We have a lot. The Passover is fulfilled in the death and resurrection of Jesus. So we observe, again, for example, communion. This would be one thing that we keep doing. But how can we engage in redundant celebration this month? This redundancy that keeps unlocking our minds, keeps opening up our hearts. For us, it's through the incarnation and telling the story. Keep telling yourself the story. Keep developing an excitement for the birth of Jesus. Watch the children get excited each year for it. Don't lose it. When you see their display of emotion, don't dismiss it. Channel it. They're teaching us something. They're teaching us how to still be excited. They can do it again. They can do it again. Chesterton said something like, God is like a toddler, raising the sun every morning and just thrilled with it happening again. May we develop a childlike faith that can watch the sunrise every morning and then pray to God, do it again. Keep going. Show me the sun again. Give me another day. Might even help some of your boredom if you feel bored. Redundancy. Tell the story again. You can do Advent again because of that. Jesus moves us to consider then, that's how to endure in human suffering as a human. God through the nations, through the people, and redemption extends to all of us. The door is wide open for humanity. And now we can all participate. Our worship, redundantly, gets us to imagine again how God makes the world turn. how the true narrative is that God keeps sustaining us, keeps holding us, keeps saving us through Jesus and the Spirit. The world can be dull, depressing, dark. Turn on the lights again. Show the world. Worship is about celebrating what Jesus has done and praising him for it. We can also do it when we share stories with each other, when we talk about how God is working. We're not just sharing the gospel so that someone gets added to our number. We're sharing the gospel because it illuminates the dark world. Even if someone doesn't follow, I'm convinced that good stories make the world brighter. Keep sharing your experience. Keep sharing what God is doing in your life. Even if it doesn't convince somebody, it might make the world a little lighter. Keep saying good things. Jesus turns on the lights. He helps us see clearly. He helps us endure suffering. The prophets could endure pain, channel God's passion, because they were seeing the world in a clarified way. He gives us the imagination to see the world as he is making it, and then enact his will in the world. And because we have nothing to fear now, we can get close. We don't have to start a revolution to save ourselves. We don't have to get rich or win an election. Jesus saves. We can get near to death, near to suffering, without fear. Jesus redeems us and redeems the world. We're showing people that. And worshiping declares that truth out loud again for all the world to hear. It reconfigures how we relate to God. And it can help remind us too. We need that courage. So keep telling the story. Keep remembering. You have the stuff.
Thanks for listening to Circle of Hope's Sunday Meeting Podcast. If you want to talk about it or get connected to a cell, you can find one under our Connect dropdown at circleofhope.net.